Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world. I'm Allison Kaplan Summer. On today's show, as we record, Israel is under its second version of its third lockdown. It's actually something like lockdown 3.2, a tightened third lockdown. This follows the failure of lockdown 3.0, where the government tried to partially shut down while keeping schools and some businesses running, which the public ignored, and so it did little to bring down the infection numbers. Cases have been spiking higher than 5,000 on a daily basis. So the government has cracked down again, schools are closed, and roadblocks are back. And at the very same time, Israel is racing ahead of the rest of the world when it comes to vaccinations. Our prime minister and today our healthcare workers have received their second dose of the Pfizer vaccine. By the end of the day, almost 2 million Israelis will have had their first vaccination, including 70% of the population 60 years old and older. And our teachers are now starting to get their vaccines. But even as Israelis focused on our local COVID woes and our vaccine obsessions, as well as the extreme jockeying taking place in our upcoming fourth elections, they still could not ignore the unbelievable images coming from Washington, D.C. last week as insurgent supporters of President Trump stormed the Capitol in a violent rampage that left 5 people dead, including 1 police officer. Later on in the podcast, we'll be talking to our new Haaretz Washington, D.C. correspondent, Ben Samuels, who was on the scene as these destructive riots broke out. But first, we have the man who used to represent the United States in Israel, former Ambassador Daniel Shapiro, currently a distinguished visiting fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv, and also my neighbor down the street. Hi, Dan. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Allison. Great to be with you.
Dan, you spent so many years of your career on Capitol Hill. Tell me what it felt like for you when you watched on television as a mob attacked the House and Senate halls and offices where you probably spent so many hours and I presume still know many people who work there.
Yes, it was really devastating, heartbreaking and outraging at the same time to see the central place of American democracy where the people's representatives meet to express their will. And on that day, we're confirming the will of the people in the presidential election to be overrun by a mob that had actually been incited to insurrection by no less than the president of the United States. There were major law enforcement failures in the inability to protect the building appropriately. But that does not in any way excuse the criminality that the protesters who broke into the building were intent on and carried out. And really, the tragedies of the 5 deaths could have been far, far greater, but for some luck and good fortune. So it was really a devastating moment in American history. Obviously, it had no effect on the outcome of the presidential election. And it may well, I think it will, result in President Trump's second impeachment before this next week is out.
So a month or two ago, when Israelis were out in the streets and, you know, banging on Balfour, where our prime minister lives, with these, you know, violent protests, I was admiring the contrast with my friends in the United States, where the election was coming up. They were phone banking, targeting their energy towards, you know, action in a democratic election. You're a foreign policy guy. You've put in so many years trying to help move countries around the world look to the norms of constitutional democracies and send the message that authoritarianism, violence, mob rule is not the way to go. These images broadcast around the world, the continued threat of violence from Trump supporters who insist on rejecting the results of a free and fair election. How do you think they're going to affect America's credibility and its stature? I mean, not just in the Middle East, but around the world. It's not every day that you see Erdogan lecturing the United States on how to run an orderly democracy, right?
It obviously is very harmful to America's image and influence and ability to set the example by our own conduct, our own democratic processes, our own values for the rest of the world. When President Trump was elected 4 years ago, nobody could out-alarm me about how much damage he was capable of doing. to the public ethics of the United States, where corruption has now run rampant in his government, to the democratic institutions of the United States, where he has now shown he has no respect for the rule of law, for free and fair elections, for the way we carry out our democratic processes, or to our international standing. And of course, a lot of that is affected by our own internal standing or problems or ability to address our own challenges. What President-elect Biden has said is that the United States has always proven most influential, not by the example of our power. Obviously, our military and our economic power is a key part of American influence, but even more so by the power of our example. When we live our own values, when we make our own democratic institutions live up to what we say they stand for, when we carry out our, particularly our public duties and our civic duties in the way our founders intended, then we have that influence in the rest of the world. When we fail, and this was a dramatic historic failure this past week, of course, many countries and societies around the world will ask the question, what does the United States have to teach us? I assume they will have to re-ask that question, and they will re-ask that question when Joe Biden becomes president. But this is a bad day, not just for America, but for America's standing in the world.
So we're recording on January 10th. How worried are you about the next 10 days? There's talk of the 25th Amendment. Impeachment proceedings are already beginning in the House. It all feels really extreme. Do you think there's actual chance? Are you really worried that Trump can do more real damage in the short time that he has remaining in office, whether it's domestic or, God forbid, foreign?
There's absolutely no question he can do tremendous additional damage as long as he holds all the powers of the presidency. He cannot prevent Joe Biden from becoming president at noon on January 20th. That will happen. But at the most extreme end, he possesses the nuclear codes that allow him to launch nuclear weapons on a few minutes' notice. He is certainly capable of dismissing significant members of the federal government. He's capable of pardoning no end of criminals, including people in his own administration who are probably subject to all sorts of legal judicial processes. He claims he has the right to pardon himself, which is something that has never been tested. There's the ability to destroy records that would be critical to future investigations of a lot of the wrongdoing that's going on. There's no question he can do an enormous amount of damage. I've just scratched the surface. Mm-hmm. But so I expect that, but even if it weren't a question of the damage he could still do, the damage he did inciting this insurrection is by itself grounds for impeachment and conviction and removal. The House of Representatives is moving forward quickly with impeachment proceedings, and I would think by the middle of the week at the latest, they will vote to impeach him. Then it's a question of whether the Senate will take up the impeachment. Because the Senate is in recess until January 19th, and it's difficult to end that recess or cut it short because it requires the unanimous consent of all senators, it is possible that the Senate will not be able to debate the question of whether to have a trial for conviction of President Trump and even the additional penalty of denying him ever the right to hold public office again until after Joe Biden has been inaugurated. That would be a somewhat awkward way to begin the Biden presidency, to have the Senate focused on a trial to convict President Trump, who's no longer president. But that'll take several more days to sort out. The impeachment is going to happen. It should happen. Frankly, if his cabinet had the guts to do the right thing, and along with the vice president, they would invoke the 25th Amendment and try to remove him that way. And if he did had any sense of historic justice, he would resign rather than see out the last 10 days of his presidency.
Yeah, well, I'm not holding my breath, so we'll see. Even with or without impeachment, 25th Amendment, the Trump brand is now, you know, if it wasn't exactly pure before, is very much stained with blood right now. And so even senior officials who stood by him for years are distancing themselves, resigning, etc. Not so Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who denounced the violence that happened on Capitol Hill, but he paired it with praising Trump as a peacemaker. My question to you, Dan, is, has Israel's brand become so attached to Trumpism within the Republican Party that some serious repair work is going to be necessary? I mean, especially now we're facing a Democratic trifecta. The Democrats are going to be in control of the White House, House of Representatives, and the Senate after the Georgia election. Can what's known as the bipartisan relationship be salvaged out of all of this?
Well, look, there's no question that many Israelis have appreciated a number of the things that President Trump did in his foreign policy as it affects Israel and the Middle East. In 4 years of being a very severe critic of President Trump, including on some of those issues, although not all of them, I never tried to convince Israelis what they should think about his foreign policies as it affected Israel's interests. I did ask them to bear in mind the damage he was doing to the United States, Israel's closest and best democratic ally, and certainly the way many Americans have felt he has done just grave damage to American civic life and institutions and international standing. And indeed, the judgment of the American people, rather soundly by presidential election standards, 7 million vote, popular vote margin, was that he should not be reelected. And of course, he also presided over the Republicans losing control of the House and the Senate over his 4 years. So look, there's much support in the Democratic Party. Certainly there will be in the Biden administration. And I think the vast majority of members of Congress for continued close relations between the United States and Israel, for strong support of Israel's security and its legitimacy, for trying to advance peace between Israel and its neighbors, including the normalization agreements of the Abraham Accords, and to revitalize Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking efforts in the direction of a two-state solution. So there's a strong reservoir of goodwill. I hope and I think Israeli leaders and officials will understand that these are now the officials and this is now the party, at least for the coming years, that will be governing U.S. policy. That's by the consent of the American people. And it's probably worth bearing in mind, as much as they may appreciate some of the things President Trump has done, that President Trump has left a very, very ugly legacy, particularly after the events of January 6th, on American society and American politics. And so as much as one may show appreciation for policies, showing a close identification with that brand, obviously, is something that won't necessarily resonate wonderfully with some parts of American society.
Axios reported that Netanyahu's inner circle is concerned that Biden is, quote, filling his administration with veterans of the Obama administration, what he calls Obama people, and because there was so much difficulty in Obama's second term between some of these staff members and the Israeli government, that they're fearful of what's ahead as a so-called Obama person. Do you think these fears are justified?
No, I think that's sort of an exaggerated and somewhat caricatured description. First of all, Vice President Biden served in that administration for 8 years and with many of these officials. Second of all, any Democratic foreign policy or government professional who has any experience, unless they're quite, you know, quite a bit older and served in the Clinton administration, would have served in the Obama administration. So it's not unlikely that we see people returning. But look, first of all, the Obama-Biden administration, while yes, there were disagreements with Israel over a number of matters, also was an administration that showed unstinting support for Israel's security in all sorts of ways, the funding of Iron Dome, the provision of the F-35 aircraft, the $38 billion memorandum of understanding, and many others. President-elect Biden was a full partner in all those. He himself comes from a long career, decades-long career in the Senate, and then as vice president, as one of Israel's most vocal and enthusiastic supporters, someone who really believes in the importance and justice of Israel's cause and the strategic importance of Israel's security for America as well as for Israel, and has said time and time again that he will do everything possible to ensure Israel's security. He will also do everything possible to advance peace between Israel and Arab states, including the Abraham Accords, and Palestinians in a two-state solution. And he'll also work to ensure Iran doesn't ever achieve a nuclear weapon. If that is the basis of the Biden administration policy, which will be carried out by all those officials, there's plenty of room for constructing a very cooperative, very common strategy on all the key issues, even though, and this happens between allies in the best of circumstances, there may be disagreements on certain points.
So you don't think a clash over Iran is unavoidable, with incoming National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan saying that Biden intends to return to the Iran deal if Iran returns to compliance and is going to seek to negotiate a broader deal. And in the meantime, we're seeing, you know, signs from Iran. They've resumed its production of enriched uranium. There have been threats to expel a nuclear inspector. You don't see the Israel and this incoming administration as two oncoming trains, you know, that will inevitably crash into each other.
Well, I wrote about this in the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago. And indeed, if you listen to the statements that Jake Sullivan and even President Biden himself have made, which say they would return to the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, in the context of mutual compliance, which is to say, if Iran starts to return to all of its obligations under the deal, and it's well out of compliance right now, you just mentioned some of the ways they are. And hear the statements of Israeli officials who say that that would be a mistake for the United States to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. There may be a disagreement. That doesn't necessarily mean a clash, but there may be an opening disagreement. I mean, there are a couple of important factors to bear in mind here. President Trump withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. Under that deal, Iran was verifiably kept at least at a year from an ability to break out to a nuclear weapon and would have been kept there for between a decade and a half. Once President Trump withdrew from the deal and then Iran started to violate its commitments, enriching uranium, installing centrifuges and the like, it has now reduced its breakout time to between 2 and 3 months. So we are now in a much more dangerous situation than we were under the deal. It is true that President Trump's sanctions against Iran have imposed a lot of economic cost on Iran, but it is also true that they've accelerated the Iran nuclear program. When Iran was this close to a nuclear weapon in 2012, Israel very seriously considered a military strike. So we are now in a dangerous situation. What I think the incoming Biden administration hopes to do is to find ways to buy time, to put some more time on the clock. One way you could do that, if Iran would comply, is rejoining the JCPOA. But essentially, that's a preliminary step. There may be other ways, by the way. What is the true Iran strategic objective for the incoming Biden administration is not defined by JCPOA or not JCPOA or other short-term ways of buying some time on the nuclear file. It is actually to try to achieve a much longer-term agreement that is much broader in its application, not just to nuclear, but also to ballistic missile technologies, and that is much stronger in terms of its enforcement and its coverage of many of Iran's other very malign behaviors all over the region. That is something that the Biden administration, I believe, or the incoming administration has already articulated as its real strategic objective. And on that, there's a great deal of convergence between Israeli and U.S., and I would argue Gulf Arab and European positions as well. And it should be possible, if everybody comes to the table in a spirit of building a common strategy, to find a way to get past initial disagreements. They're not insignificant. They are important. But not let that become the sole focus of the discussion. Rather, to come up with the incentives and the leverage and the pressures necessary to get Iran into that negotiation on the longer-term agreement that will really meet all these parties' interests and desired outcomes.
On the Palestinian front, think tank, the Center for a New American Security, released a report written by three experts you know pretty well, Tamara Kaufman-Witte, Zilan Goldenberg, Michael Koplow. They call for a fundamental rethink of how the United States approaches the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And specifically, it urges America to avoid harmful, high-profile diplomatic initiatives in favor of tangible actions that would lead to diplomatic and on-the-ground improvements. Witte's sees appointing an Israeli-Palestinian envoy as a, quote, bad idea. Both Witte's and Koplow told Haaretz's Ben Samuels that there is, quote, near unanimity within democratic foreign policy circles that talks between the two sides have zero chance of being successful right now. Do you agree with them?
I don't think there's any sign that the current Israeli leadership and the current Palestinian leadership are inclined to return to final status talks, or that if they were brought, maybe dragged, to final status talks, that they would go very well. These are, of course, the same leaders who have negotiated previously during the Obama administration. It's the same leadership for over a decade now. There's enormous distrust. There's the legacy of failed negotiations. it's highly unlikely that they, or really the two societies, are ready for the kind of negotiation and the kind of compromises that that negotiation would require, that it makes it advisable to rush forward and do that. What I do think a Biden administration is likely to do is articulate the goal, maybe re-articulate the goal of a two-state solution, and much more on the model that we've thought about it over the previous two decades than the version that is laid out in the Trump plan, which is not a two-state solution in any meaningful sense other than using the name. And make sure that is understood to be the strategic objective of the United States, and start to work in a way with Israelis, Palestinians, Arab states, Europeans, and others to sustain the viability of that outcome, to keep it alive while you can't negotiate, to make sure that the next time it's viable to bring Israeli and Palestinian leaders, and there may be changes in leaderships, back to the negotiating table, it's still possible to negotiate a two-state solution. So that means addressing concerns on the ground of building up Palestinian economic and institutional infrastructure. It means improving security cooperation between Israelis and Palestinians. It means calling on Palestinians to end the things they do that make this harder, delegitimization and incitement and payments to terrorists who sit in Israeli prisons, and calling on Israelis not to do the things that make this harder, settlement expansion and talk of annexation. And it also means looking for a role for Arab states who are normalizing their relations with Israel, like the UAE and Bahrain and others, a very welcome development, welcomed by Joe Biden while he was a candidate, in the hope that they have an ability as partners to both Israelis and Palestinians to help create incentives and platforms and an atmosphere in which the overall attitudes can be improved and the overall economic and security and societal conditions can be improved in advance of a hopefully resumed negotiation later. It may be later in a Biden administration or maybe even beyond a Biden administration. So it's about keeping that two-state solution and vision alive and viable. And there's a role that U.S., Israel, Palestinians, Arabs, and others can play to do that.
So, Dan, you've been very disciplined. I've interviewed you many times. Whenever I've asked you about your successor, Ambassador David Friedman, you've been, excuse the expression, diplomatic about not talking about your successor and the kind of job that he's doing in your old job. But today, his farewell interview appears in the New York Times, talking about how he, quote, etched his name in history as one of America's most influential envoys, saying that he drove the radical overhaul of White House policy towards the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, crediting him with being behind the push for moving the embassy to Jerusalem for the first time as U.S. ambassador to Israel, visiting West Bank settlements, banishing the term occupied from State Department documents, cheering on cutting financial support to Palestinians, and actively pushing for annexation, even helping the Israeli government internally debate annexation. But he had to back down on that, of course, when the deal with the Gulf states, the Abraham Accords, took shape, giving Israel the option of normalization with these states instead of annexation. The Times quotes him as saying, quote, "There's no going back on what we've been able to do. I'm frankly somewhere between addicted and intoxicated with what I've been able to do and how much joy it gives me. We've changed the narrative dramatically." So, Dan, I know you've had this policy, but it's the end. There's only a week and a half left of David Friedman's time in office. He seems to be letting it all hang out now, so I think you can too. What do you make of David Friedman's legacy as U.S. ambassador to Israel?
Allison, I'm going to be sorry to disappoint you.
Oh, no.
I'm going to talk about the Trump administration's policies, and I'm not going to talk about personalities. The Trump administration policies are among them those that have obviously made a two-state solution harder. That's obviously not only on them. There are many actions that Palestinians and Israelis have taken that have also made that harder. But certainly any U.S. role to be a mediator in the conflict needs to be facilitated by the ability to have positive diplomacy conducted with both sides. And it's been over 3 years since there's been any serious diplomatic communication between the United States and the Palestinians. Some of that responsibility falls on the Palestinian side, but the Trump administration was never able to overcome that hurdle. And it meant that they then produced a plan that was essentially worked out with only one side. And so it's obviously not a viable plan. It also meant closing a consulate to deal with the Palestinian Authority in Jerusalem, closing the PLO office in Washington, cutting off virtually all assistance to Palestinians, including humanitarian assistance and security assistance to help with Israeli-Palestinian security cooperation, none of which was required under laws that do require reducing some Palestinian assistance because of payments made to terrorist attacks, a law, by the way, that Joe Biden supports. And so there's a lot of things that a Biden administration already comes in having said during the campaign they would reverse, and I mentioned some of those. It doesn't mean everything will be reversed. I'm sure the embassy will remain in Jerusalem. President-elect Biden has said that. President-elect Biden did also welcome the Abraham Accords, and he said that this is in furtherance of a longstanding U.S. bipartisan priority to get Israel's relations normalized and get it the recognition it deserves in the Arab world, and he would work to expand that. And also, he found it to be very, very important that the agreement with the United Arab Emirates put the then widely discussed possibility of Israeli annexation in the West Bank on ice. It will certainly remain on ice during a Biden administration. It would have been really the literal end of the two-state solution. And that he wants to draw some positive momentum on Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking out of these Arab-Israeli relations, which I spoke about a moment ago. The Biden administration has a new tool, the Middle East Peace Partnership Fund, that was just passed by Congress, named for former Congresswoman Nita Lowey, that will provide significant funding for Israeli-Palestinian people-to-people peacemaking programs and funds to support Palestinian economic development. That's a new tool. The Arab relations with Israel and the Palestinians, as I spoke about, is a new tool. And so I expect a Biden administration will work in all of these streams to promote the very things Biden has always stood for and that have really have always been central to the U.S.-Israel relationship. So whoever is the next ambassador to Israel will obviously carry out that policy. I hope they will do so alongside a U.S. consul general dealing with the Palestinian Authority. That's an important colleague for that person, so that the U.S. government is able to speak with both parties to this conflict, and that they will be able to make progress, some of it reversing Trump administration policies I think were mistaken, and some of it carrying forward longstanding U.S. commitments.
But first, they'll have to go house hunting because your old residence, the ambassador resides now, has been sold to Sheldon Adelson, who is apparently leasing it back to the U.S. To the U.S. ambassador. I find it hard to imagine Sheldon Adelson being the landlord of Biden's ambassador, but I guess anything's possible, right?
this is a decision that the State Department will have to figure out where that new ambassador is going to reside, and they have a little time to do that because they haven't nominated anybody. It'll take a few months for a nomination and a confirmation. And so they'll come up with an answer.
Dan Shapiro, thank you so much for joining us on Haaretz Weekly.
My pleasure.
And now I turn to Ben Samuels, who has had a heck of a first few weeks transitioning into the role of Haaretz U.S. correspondent based in Washington, D.C. Hi, Ben. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So I hate to break it to you, but in the old days, getting into the role of D.C. journalist involved long, boozy lunches with congressional aides, hanging out in Capitol Hill offices, getting the lay of the land. That's not exactly what you've been doing, I suppose.
Not exactly. You know, I was speaking with a source the other day, and he was like, wow, I really hope this isn't your first week. And I said, God forbid, it's my second.
Yeah, so you're an old pro now. So tell us about the lead up to the unprecedented scene on Capitol Hill on Wednesday. I don't even know what to call it without using obscenities. From what you said and did, is it something that you would have seen coming? I know that you spent a lot of time there beforehand, before really all hell broke loose. And, you know, for all of the anti-Semitic sightings there, the guy in the Camp Auschwitz T-shirt and the like, there were also some Jewish participants in it, right?
Yeah, I mean, there were a few Israeli flags spotted in the crowd, but by no means was this a Stand With Israel rally. You know, our colleague Daniel Ziri wrote a very thoughtful column before the rally highlighting the Jews who were attending, so I encourage our listeners to read that article. For myself, you know, I was walking back and forth about a mile and a half on Pennsylvania Avenue between the site of the rally and the Capitol, trying to find Israelis or Jews to speak with. And, you know, this was very much not a significant element of the crowd, but you know, it really did feel tense from the moment I arrived very early in the morning. And the crowds, as they were moving west toward the ellipse, you know, it was pretty kitschy. You know, there were floats playing MAGA to the tune of YMCA and people wearing Superman costumes with Trump masks. And, you know, it almost had like a festive atmosphere with people hawking knockoff T-shirts, you know, selling refreshments on the way. And, you know, believe it or not, no one was quite interested in speaking with a Jewish American journalist representing an Israeli newspaper.
Shocking.
So, right. So
but I mean, were there any indication that these people had, you know, grenades and guns, et cetera, that there were armed people there?
Well, so, you know, as the day progressed, there was very much a moment where the crowds started moving east instead of west toward the Capitol. And the chants turned much more violent. You know, there were lots of sexist and racist chants concerning Kamala Harris and Nancy Pelosi, threats of violence against Chuck Schumer, calls to burn it all down, to take back our country. You know, the rhetoric started getting much more aggressive. And along with that rhetoric, you know, I started seeing much more people wearing military garb and other identifying clothing and markings, showing their membership or alliance with militias and far-right extremist groups. And, you know, along with that, I also saw firsthand several Confederate flags and overheard your standard dog whistle comments about the banks and the Rothschilds, Soros. You know, I didn't see the Camp Auschwitz shirt that has become, you know, one of the ubiquitous images of the demonstration. But, you know, it was very clear early on that the atmosphere was tense, that there was going to be violence. But I think what was so shocking is how successful they were in overrunning the Capitol and how little resistance there was from law enforcement.
So, I mean, even before Wednesday, you know, we've got the background of what happened in Pittsburgh and in California. It's been a hallmark of the Trump era, a lot of concern among American Jews about anti-Semitic violence. Just before the incident last week, you spoke to Anti-Defamation League CEO Jonathan Greenblatt and American Jewish Committee Director for Combating Anti-Semitism Holly Hufnagel. You were talking to them about worries about anti-Semitism. There's been a lot of talk about how Israel has become a partisan issue in the Trump era. Do they feel the same thing has happened when it comes to fighting anti-Semitism? And what are their ideas about how the Biden administration can pick up the pieces after the Trump era and try to work to reduce the threat level?
So Greenblatt and Hufnagel both made clear that there's been an empirical rise in far-right extremist groups and in crime since Donald Trump came on the political scene. They made the point that even if Trump is not a white supremacist himself, he has undoubtedly empowered and emboldened white supremacists with his rhetoric and his actions. So the events over the past week, you know, it's been called a bookend to Charlottesville. But there have been a number of anti-Semitic attacks in the time between, you know, such as Pittsburgh and Poway. So, you know, Hufnagel brought up the point that more than half the U.S. Jewish institutions have increased security in the past 2 years, and every third American Jew has avoided certain places due to safety concerns. So, you know, I don't know if these numbers will rise because of the events at the Capitol, but, you know, they definitely put a certain evil on public display. And in terms of Biden coming in, you know, he has been an outspoken friend of the Jewish community for 5 decades, and he will undoubtedly be welcomed with open arms. You know, he even specifically highlighted the events in Charlottesville when he announced his candidacy, and much of his campaign was based around defeating the scourge of extremism and healing the country. So when I asked Greenblatt and Hufnagel what steps Biden can take to combat the far right, you know, they both pointed out the need for Biden to be a leader and to really demonstrate this leadership on his first day. And, you know, the fundamental lack of leadership displayed by Trump is very much created a void where Biden can step in and start putting things on the right path from day one. You know, and they also both highlighted the importance of having a whole of government approach to taking on the issue and understanding that the entire federal government needs to work in concert. And Hufnagel went as far as to suggest a point person who should liaise between the White House, Congress, and the different federal agencies, while also, you know, having an appropriate dedication to prosecuting these crimes rather than just passing laws and reporting them.
Now, it seems like a million years ago, but the day before Wednesday, Tuesday, history happened. Two Democrats, African-American Reverend Raphael Warnock and a Jewish candidate for the Senate, John Ossoff, won these fierce close races in Georgia, which flipped the Senate to Democratic control. So there's been a lot made of Warnock's historic achievement as the first African-American senator from Georgia, the first Black Democratic U.S. senator elected in the South ever. But you also wrote that Ossoff Ossoff's win makes Jewish history. In what way is that?
So John Ossoff is the 37th Jewish senator ever elected, and he is going to be the 9th Jewish senator in current iteration of Congress. He's the first ever Jewish senator from Georgia, and he's the first Jewish senator from a deep South state since the 1880s. And coincidentally, he's also the youngest Democratic senator elected since Joe Biden. So not only that, but his victory makes Chuck Schumer, who's 37 years older than Ossoff, the first Jewish Senate majority leader. And, you know, it's a remarkable moment in American Jewish history for several reasons, but it's particularly interesting considering Georgia's history. So, you know, Georgia's always been sort of a bellwether state of the South. And, you know, there have been anti-Semitic attacks by the KKK dating back to the Civil War era. And the 1930 trial of Leo Frank, who was a Jewish businessman who was convicted of raping and murdering a 13-year-old employee, was riddled with anti-Semitism. And historians now believe that he actually was innocent. And he was lynched when his death sentence was turned into a life sentence. And the whole series of events spawned the Anti-Defamation League. And, you know, Ossoff often talked about his Jewish heritage on the campaign trail, discussing how it instilled a conviction to fight for the marginalized. And he also specifically credited his relationship with Warnock and the Greater Black Jewish Alliance for helping turn the Senate blue.
I think I'm going to end on that upbeat note. It's been such a difficult week. I want to feel happy about the Ossoff victory and what lies ahead, instead of thinking too much about the really troubling events that you partially witnessed on Wednesday. Thanks so much, Ben, for coming on, and good luck in your new job.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to my previous guest, Dan Shapiro. Dear listeners of Haaretz Weekly, it has been a wonderful and fascinating month hosting the show, but all good things have to come to an end. Simon Spungen has returned from his vacation and will be taking the reins of this podcast back. So don't forget to listen to him, and don't forget to listen to Anshel Pfeffer and Dalia Scheinlin. Follow the antics of our unprecedented fourth election in Israel on their new Election Overdose podcast. If you really can't get enough of Israeli podcasts, of Israeli politics, and want a dose of me now and then, I'm a regular co-host of the Promise podcast on TLV1. But most importantly, don't forget to tune into Simon with another edition of Haaretz Weekly next week. I know that I'll be listening. And with that, I bid you all shalom from Tel Aviv.